gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 150. It is a quarter quell. It's very exciting. It's a little bit out of order. It is February 6th, 2017. We had to get ourselves together a little bit. But I think the theme of this year's quell makes sense for the time that we're doing it. And maybe Patches should explain how that all makes sense.
Sure, yeah.
You can excuse our lateness and make it sound like a concept.
Yeah, I guess so. We'll figure it out on the fly here a little bit. But as people know who listen to the show, we kind of had a contest asking people what we should talk about for this quarter quell, because we've talked about a lot of different part of our lives over the years and sharing stories about seeing movies and that intersecting with other portions of our existence. And not that we were coming up dry, but I think I was the most curious about just knowing what people wanted to hear, not to give the people what they want, since that's clearly not a tourist way of podcasting, but just to hear from everybody who's been listening over the years, and maybe they would come up with a better idea than we could. So we kind of put it out there.
Well, we get more feedback about quarter quells than just by any other kind of episode. So clearly people are invested.
That is true. People like it. They enjoy it. Maybe they see some of themselves in those podcasts, or hear some of themselves in those podcasts. That seems more appropriate. Anyway, we had a contest and there were going to be a bunch of winners, but we picked one person whose idea we're kind of morphing a little bit just to make sure we can all have answers to it. But we picked listener Cyrus. I'm going to destroy this name. Cyrus Bastarache. You'll have to tell me how you say your name, Cyrus, but we picked your answer. You'll win the prizes of your choice, and there's going to be a couple more winners that we'll figure out on the next show, or we'll contact you. But Cyrus is the main winner, so he gets the La Land poster or the Manchester by the Sea poster, whatever we're giving away, he gets it. So he left a message on our Facebook page that read thusly, what movie would you make the incoming president sit down and watch? Maybe perspective in its POV as an empathy machine, all while using cinematic technique to send a message that would otherwise fall on deaf ears. Or to be less political, you could frame it as something you would show any incoming leader or any person for that matter. And we kind of ran with this and thought about what movies, you know, would set a tone for the world we want to live in, the world we want to see.
The America we want to see specifically.
In these troubled times, you know, people familiar with the podcast know that we can get a little political. Who can't at this current moment? It's inevitable.
Everything is political these days.
But you're everything is political.
It's the
you're right,
hit
Katie, but...
Lego sequel to Everything Is Awesome.
Yeah, the real hit. Mm-hmm. But I guess the question for us is, if everything is political, how can we? I mean, is that the world you want to live in, where everything's political? Is there a way to change that? Or is there a way to live where things are political and things are personal or whatever? What world do you want to live in? What movie seems to achieve that for you on some level? And you can take that and run with it, whatever metaphor you want to apply. So that's how we're approaching Quarter Quell. Maybe I think it'll still be personal, but it's speaking to the world right now, and I'm sure we could all use a moment to speak to each other about this political climate, about this societal climate. It's a weird place to be right now, and let's all get huddled together and be closer through movies. So that's the quarter quell.
But and not television. Fuck television.
And never television. No. No one's ever emotionally connected to television. Ever.
No, we have no feelings about television whatsoever. No.
I missed Lost.
Well, I'm not licked. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause. Somebody will listen to me. Somebody will.
I believe the senator has yielded the floor.
Yield this, Senator Payne. I move we impose some serious term limits.
I second that motion with a vengeance.
All in favor, say die.
Okay.
I was going to say, is that on with the show? I guess we'll just kick off. And how do we usually segue here?
Yeah, I'm going to go first this quarter quell with the oldest movie on today's show, which I realize we kept you all in suspense with, but it's probably in your show notes. I picked Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, a 1939 Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart movie that is, I don't know, mostly YouTubed around today for, yeah, it's like showing people what a filibuster is, which, you know, is a fine use for it. The reason that I sort of happened across this movie the first time is, I think I might have mentioned a couple times on the podcast, but for new listeners, my family sort of developed a love for movies along with a Blockbuster membership in the AFI Top 100 that was released, I believe, in like 96, late 96, early 97. And using that list, my family started going through all the top 100 AFI movies that we hadn't seen, which was most of them because I was a child. And I think there was a period of time where we decided to have like a old quote-unquote movie night, which is a whole bunch of the older black and white selections from the AFI Top 100. And a lot of those things would drag. Not to say that they weren't great movies, but in terms of keeping the attention of a preteen, not necessarily great. But for some reason, number 20 is It's a Wonderful Life, which is close, but not quite where we go. Number 26 on the AFI Top 100, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from 1939, sort of pivoted in my binge watching of old black and white movies, and it got me actually thinking about politics in a way that, like, I don't think, in terms of, like, media that makes you, like, suddenly politically aware, there are, like, all these, like, baby steps when you, like, it's sort of like realizing that your parents are people with, like, emotional lives. Like, once you start realizing, like, how futzy politics gets.
Sorry, I had to.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I don't know. Schoolhouse Rock's amendment song is, like, perfectly, you know.
I'm an amendment to be, yes, an amendment to be. That song?
Yeah, educational, perfectly valid first step into the political world. It's interesting that Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was like my 90s introduction to being interested about politics, since as like the time period that it was released, and as earnest as it tries to be about teaching people what democracy is through
this
like
this is what democracy looks like. You
exactly. I think it kind of ends up being viewed through the lens of history is like this one burst of goodwill we had before we went and fought the fascists, which means that somewhere in America, we had people that were debating what sort of government America should have. You had the, you know, famous Nazi sympathizers in Hollywood at the time, or you had more rampant communists. All of these things that I did not live through and have, like, no way of experiencing, but the reaction of Hollywood in that way was to give us this feel-good movie about democracy that is very plotty for no reason, and then lets Jimmy Stewart get away with, I don't know, just having watery eyes and looking off distance while they crossfade historical monuments in front of him, and
he's very good at that.
He is. It doesn't really function as a narrative. It functions more like a play in terms of like a narrative, and I don't think that it's like a gripping film at all of its points. But in terms of like a general push towards, we're going to sit down and give you a very simple but very I don't know, taut little pop thriller about the rules of the U.S. Senate. It was really sort of amazing to me at a time where I don't think I would have gone on to, you know, do, you know, Hunter S. Thompson and then later like actual Woodward and Bernstein and then now like journalists that I actually enjoy. I don't think I'd be able to find the sort of journalism with a perspective if I wasn't able to understand that politics was made out of people, which before I saw Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was just more like a system of rules. And so I feel now that we're in a time period where we are going to have to go beyond those systems of rules, or we're going to have those rules either tested or someone's going to claim those rules never existed. that it's really important to remember that it's just all these people slamming up against each other, maybe with a few exceptions in our current political landscape. But in terms of a overall picture, I feel like the purity of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, much like It's a Wonderful Life, is a purity that should exist, even if it is sometimes too like saccharine sweet for its subject matter. Did I manage to actually lure anybody into rewatching Mr. Smith Goes to Washington this week?
Well, it's funny that you're talking about the movie as being right at the, you know, 1939 and the climate in which it was made and the hokey spirit with which it was made feels as pre-World War II as a lot of the movies that were made right before 9/11 feel, defined by how they were made in the shadow of that world-changing event. But what is old is new again, and the ideas that are more eternally recurring, such as the sort of fight over justice and purity that you see in Decency and Democracy that you see in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, feels relevant all over again. I mean, I think Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is one of Frank Capra's hokiest and least engaging movies, but the ideas that it is promoting are as relevant now as ever. And I think, you know, second to something like A Face in the Crowd, which speaks more explicitly to what's happening right now with more of an edge for sure. I think the general fight between ethics and power that we're seeing on display now is, yeah, it's laid out in the most didactic, but therefore sort of appreciable fashion in the end of this movie.
So I know, I don't want you to get into a whole plot summary of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but I, you know, there are people listening to this who haven't seen it in a while or haven't seen it. And I think it's interesting that this movie kind of isn't just like this idealist crusader winds up in Washington, but it's got some cynicism built in. It's about him kind of having his ideals stripped away from him and fighting for them. So what is it specifically about the story you think that, that connected with you, Dave, in a way that wasn't just like, here's how a bill becomes a law?
Well, because I think it's also important that you brought up that it is sort of like he has everything stripped away from him. So he's like this Boy Scout leader, I think, like literally, that comes from great state, quote, and is sort of appointed to replace a dying senator for a period of time in his turn. He doesn't know the other senator, played by Claude Rains from his state, is running like a corrupt deal. And is expecting a yes man and accidentally proposes new legislation to build like a boys camp on this land that the deal depends on. So it's all about Jimmy Stewart realizing that he can't fight Washington graft. And then he finally does beat it by filibustering for so long that he passes out. And as they're carrying him out, the other senator has like a crisis of conscience, tries to commit suicide, fails. And so there's this blurting out on the floor of the Senate that the whole thing was a plot. And Jimmy Stewart doesn't even wake up to see this like conclusion of his own movie. So from that character's standpoint, like he just gets broken. And he's like, I'm not going to give up. Passes out. End of movie. Mr. Smith went to Washington and basically failed from his perspective.
Clearly it'd be great
interesting.
If we had politicians like Claude Rains' Senator Payne who would feel guilty. And hand over.
Is this you wishing that Paul Ryan would just repent on the floor of the House?
I mean, it's interesting to see that this repentance comes after they literally are making up evidence against him to frame him for supposedly. They try to frame Jefferson Smith for being the one that's actually trying to pull the graft game. And it's like literally fake news. And then the whole conclusion, well, the whole conclusion of this, you know, movie is about, not about the filibuster or what he says during the filibuster, because he's filibustering the plot of his own film, but it's about, the, I guess sort of like, newspaper magnate rich man who's trying to control all these politicians starts buying out local newspapers so that nobody back home in his state knows that he's filibustering, which now is like basically a parallel where that's where the battle's happening, because the voice still needs to come from the state regardless. So his like great failure in his eyes is because the news of his success in his state is withheld from him, and instead he sees all of these discouraging fake news telegrams. So it's really like, you know, news versus legislation versus Senate rules. You know, the, I don't know, rules-obsessed Geek Dave definitely dug well, into all that.
Even if all of Frank Capra's movies, and certainly this one, get hokier by the day, it is strange how, and strange is the nicest word I can think to describe it, how Mr. Smith Goes to Washington has only become more plausible in a way. It's boomeranged around. Where
really?
Now, I think so. And I'm not... I don't know how one could argue the contrary. I mean, we're living in the time now where people are manufacturing fake news in order. I mean, you have a, we're living in
well,
the
I guess
age
that
of
aspect
Sean
of the movie, that aspect of the movie, are you, I don't think I could argue that the entire movie has boomeranged around as if the system well, works to allow, Mr. Smith. That would be what a full boomerang would be, but
well,
there
Mr.,
are aspects
Mr.,
of it that are relevant.
Mr. Smith was an implausible character then, the sort of country bumpkin who's just like Kenneth from 30 Rock, just gawking at the Lincoln Memorial and everything, the Lincoln Monument, and everything else. I think having someone that guileless coming into Washington, D.C. now seems very implausible, but and everything
well, I mean,
else that happens in the movie. But the general arc of it, I think, makes a certain amount of sense these days.
I mean, Jefferson Smith would have gotten, you know, shellacked like the rube he was if he didn't have Gene Arthur Saunders basically, you know, pulling him up by his bootstraps and telling him what to do and writing his bill for him. So I think, like, that, you know, G. Willikers person is always going to be chewed up by Washington, but it is interesting that in this movie it's like a woman redirects him. It sucks that she kind of has to like fall in love with him from the Senate gallery, but you know, what are you going to do? It's 1989.
Dave, I know you're a very angry person when it comes to politics. You become enraged. You want a battle here. This is not the world that we live in. Now, of course, the prompt is pick a movie that you would want the world, like we want this America where a Mr. Smith could prevail, but it's just... Is it actually,
sure.
Would it help?
Well, I thought I met if Trump supporters if, halfway because this movie's overwhelmingly white.
Black and white.
All of our choices are overwhelmingly white.
Not
for
mine.
What it's worth.
No.
That's true. Yours is less white.
No, it was very interesting rewatching this movie and having Java come in every like half an hour to make snide comments about all the white people on screen talking about democracy.
Well,
and I was
Dave,
like, fair enough.
My real point is that wouldn't a Mr. Smith, if this world could exist today, wouldn't the Mr. Smiths of the world kind of be your enemy? Wouldn't they wind up using the system and their roots and the people against what you believe in?
I mean, the reality of the Mr. Smith narrative is the Claude Rains senator doesn't have a crisis of conscience and he passes out and the bill passes, which is what happens all the time. But I think it's just... I don't know if wanting to see this movie... Everybody in this movie ends up making the right decision for their character. I kind of wish that if we're going to deal with politicians that are going to be larger-than-life characters, I would at least like to see some consistency in what they're portraying and what they're elected for and what actually happens. I think this movie sort of plays with that idea without coming on a side on whether that's good or bad and if it should be and if it shouldn't be, because basically everybody ends up being dirty except for the guy who's literally unconscious at the end. And for varying means, the reporters in this movie are nasty to politicians for what they feel are very legitimate means reasons. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of divisiveness in this movie, but like all good things, it's not coming up to like pick a fight with you. It's just there if you want to pick at it.
So Dave, I think the pop culture legacy of this movie is the idea that like one man can stand up for what he believes in and accomplish something. Like if you want to stand up on the Senate floor and filibuster, like you can be the force of change. Does watching this movie make you believe in that, even if kind of rationally you realize it never happens that way?
I think it's important for everybody who is, you know, in that position, the person in the chair, to believe that or at least know that they have to go down believing that if they want to be seen as a principled person. I don't know if it gives me much hope that that still exists, but I don't think it existed in 1939 when this movie was made anyway. So it's a representation of that ideal for sure. I think now we're just, it's much more complex in our current empire. But I think we can all learn from the end of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington that if your state representative is filibustering, maybe you should be trying to figure out what they're saying.
Whoa.
You're a part-time lover and a full-time friend. The monkey on your back is the latest trend. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else. But
I'll kiss you on the brain in the shadow of the train. Kiss you all starry-eyed, my body swinging from side to side. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else. But
here is the church and here is the steeple. We sure are cute for two ugly people. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else. But
the pebbles forgive me, the trees forgive me, so why can't you?
So when I was trying to figure out what movie to choose, I kind of really wanted to go with something that like pictured a world that I want to live in some way. And I tried to think of something that represented women and tried to think of something that wasn't kind of stuck in the point of view of one, you know, a city elite or some kind. I wanted to think about small towns because I come from a small town, but I didn't want something that was kind of idealizing like the real hardworking Americans. Like I think about the beginning of the Transformers movie with Mark Wahlberg in it, which is you know, a level of absurdity. So I wound up coming around to Juno, which is the 2007 movie. It is 10 years old, which is terrifying. Directed by Jason Reitman and written by Diablo Cody, that if you were around in 2007, you definitely remember this movie was everywhere. It is a period of time in which Michael Cera was a movie star, which is really weird to think about in retrospect. This movie kind of got memeified to the point that it was really hard to see on its own terms for a long time. Like the music and the catchphrases and Honest to Blog and the hamburger phone and the whole story of Diablo Cody is this former stripper writer who wore this leopard print dress at the Oscars. It all became such a big thing. And I think that if you haven't seen it since 2007, it really, rewatching it kind of presents a lot where you can just really get outside of all of that noise. And I think this movie holds up, which I, you know, is a big reason that I chose it. And I think the thing that I take away from it so much more now, beyond all the catchphrase stuff, is the way that it deals with small town America. You know, you've got this character in Juno, played by Ellen Page, who's like really clever and smart, and you can kind of tell she thinks she's better than the people around her. And she enters into this adoption scenario with Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman's character, and she's pretty glib about it. Like she, I don't remember what her line is, but something, you know, like pop out the baby and move on with her life. And the way that the story tracks her, it kind of tracks her emotional development. It's a coming of age story in that way. But it does this really smart thing where it kind of has you identify with her from the beginning and get a little blindsided by the things in the way that she is, where you kind of see uptight Jennifer Garner is more sympathetic and Jason Bateman is kind of slowly revealed to be pathetic. And I think that's a nice way to look at the milieu of Juno for those of us watching it from inside a city, where we see this and say like, oh, well, you know, this is some dumpy little Minnesota town, but this is the cool kid who lives there. And then kind of slowly be told what an asshole you are for thinking that way.
Wait, can I ask, and I think, can I ask a sincere question?
Yeah.
Because I don't know if it matters. I don't know if it's just a matter of semantics, but I don't think small town when I watch Juno. I think suburbs. And there's
That's true. That is a flyover country, I guess, is kind of the vaguest way you can say it, which is the way a lot of people think of, you know, where I'm from, which is a legitimate small town in the South, and also the Minnesota suburbs.
If you live in Minnesota, you live in a small town automatically somehow. That's what you're saying?
Or just, I mean, I was just using small town as kind of shorthand for anywhere that isn't New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, et cetera.
Right.
And I think that, you know, and I definitely have a personal connection to it because I wasn't nearly as interesting or hip as Juno or as sensible in some ways. But I definitely had, you know, the feeling growing up in a small town where I was better than the people around me and I was smarter than things and I could handle like, I was just able to handle stuff and I knew everything in the way that a lot of teenagers do. But I think, you know, thinking that I was going to move to a big city and be cool and listen to cool music was a big part of it. And the way that Juno, the character, kind of doesn't really explicitly learn any of that, but the way that she interacts with people around her. I think it's both a movie set in a suburb saying, yes, there are smart, interesting people here. And also watching a character learn that. And the, you know, the town that she's in is interesting. Like, the way that J.K. Simmons and Allison Janney play her dad and stepmom is really good. It's really careful with all of its characters and sympathetic and makes them all real people.
They are cool
and
parents.
They're cool parents, but like not, like J.K. Simmons is like stern and she kind of thinks that Allison Janney is dumb, but also, you know, respects her. Like there's complexity to every single character that's in there. And that for me is like putting it broadly toward America is just like having interest in other people and other people's perspectives. I think that's kind of explicitly the text of the movie, and it's something I think about every time I watch it. And it's extremely white. I don't think it does a good job of like the way we really need this, so just to see the perspectives of people who aren't in your race or religion or something like that. But you know, it's a start.
Can we back up to the part where you were cooler than everyone in your town?
No. I thought I
no,
was
I know
cooler.
You, no, I know you thought. I know you thought. So what? How did you unthink that?
What did you learn?
Because I don't think you got pregnant and had a baby.
I did not.
That happened.
I did.
Then you just learned that you're not as cool as you
think
you are.
I finally had a baby and then figured out what was going on. I went to college in Connecticut and I, you know, met a bunch of people who knew a whole lot more than I ever did. And I realized that, you know, me thinking that I knew indie films was a joke compared to the kids who grew up going to the Angelica. And then I went home and saw my family and liked them. And, you know, every time I went back, I kind of was able to interact with them more as an adult, not as a sullen teenager. I don't think that's super uncommon.
I'm still waiting for David to learn this lesson, frankly.
No. That he's not too cool?
Oh, no comeback? Come on!
Apparently that is not today.
I was just trying to square that with my self-image and be like, no, that's doesn't quite fair. Check out.
So for you guys, like, does the heart of Juno outweigh its meme-ness at this point?
Well, is it about, I don't know if it needs to outweigh its meminess, but you've picked a film that's about a girl who thinks she should get an abortion and is too scared to.
No, that's really interesting.
I don't think that's what it's about.
Well,
it's not
it's
about that, of course, but this is what happens.
I mean, I think we probably all remember that Juno and Knocked Up came out the same year, and both of them feature a character. Yeah, so Juno doesn't have the same pop out of Schmorschen, but it has a character who chooses not to get an abortion, which, you know, is what sets the plot in motion. If there's no abortion, there's no story.
Is there a scene where she says, I'm afraid to have the baby? I mean, I know she goes to the abortion clinic, and the girl that's there is, you know, proselytizing about fetuses and whatnot.
She's scared about the fingernails in her baby. Well, she's not like...
No, she's not
scared.
She feels
bad. She's
pressured.
She feels social pressure.
She sees other people's fingernails and she thinks of the baby as a person and not just a fetus.
I think in fairness to not to talk over the one woman on the podcast. I thought Katie was more or less done. But I think in fairness to Diablo Cody, it's more complicated than that. I think that it's sort of this understandably human complex...
I'm not saying it's not complicated. I'm just saying this is what happens in the movie. This is what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, she feels a pressure, and she doesn't. No one talks to her about having an abortion, so she just has the baby. She makes a decision. Her parents.
I don't think it's pressure as much as kind of like a realization that she comes to on her own of thinking of it as a baby and not as a fetus, which I think likely happens to plenty of people. I mean, she walks by the girl, the classmate who's protesting in the parking lot doesn't really seem to faze her when she walks out. She's just kind of made up her mind. And I think in a vacuum, like that's a perfectly valid storytelling choice. The fact that there are so few movies that do feature abortions makes it more problematic. I'm really grateful that Obvious Child came around a couple years later to show that you can have a movie in which there's an abortion that doesn't just like erase the plot entirely. But yeah, I mean, it's a complex issue that
I don't think
makes it another way that Juno reflects America.
I should say. It's not.
No,
I don't think so either. I do think that, as great as I share Katie's sentiments 100%, that it's great that we have a movie where the lead character does get an abortion and that's the movie. It doesn't negate the movie. But yeah, I think it's easy enough to recognize the dramatic drawbacks of having a character who gets pregnant as the inciting incident and then immediately decides to have an abortion.
Yeah, I mean, I, Katie, I think this movie holds up, as you said earlier, against all the meminess. I actually love the stylized dialogue in the beginning, too. Like,
this
is a slice of
Rainn Wilson
life that is completely foreign to me, even though I was probably the same age as, or around the same age as Juno when the movie came out. So,
no, you were not.
What year is this? 2007?
2007.
What year is it?
You were in college.
Yeah, I guess, no. No, it wasn't.
No, you
wasn't
were definitely I? In college.
You I definitely was in college. Yeah, college. I was out of college.
I saw this at the Union Square movie theater. No, you're right.
I was in college. Yeah. So I'm a little older than Juno, but it was still like, this. Who talks like this? I mean, it's a crazy...
No, no one talks like this. That's the whole yeah. point.
But what?
But no
how
one
do you
talks
think
like
that...
people in Quentin Tarantino movies either.
Do you think that the language plays into what you're talking about? Does the memeified aspects or what became memeified actually make this movie work for its message, you know?
Yeah, because I think you get a character like the Jennifer Garner character who can't keep up with any of that, who is kind of this very normal, boring person in this McMansion and like boring sweater sets. And you kind of look down on her at first because the dialogue is fun and you like it being zippy. And then the movie evolves and you kind of slowly come around to seeing her as a human being. And I think that's a, you know, it's the fun dialogue kind of stands in for teenager slang, which is actually might be interesting because it's instead of using whatever slang was popular in 2007, it makes up its own slang that might make it more timeless.
Tubular.
Oh, right.
I think that it works because the characters at least have the movie has the courage of its own convictions. I mean, these characters all believe one another and how they speak and how they act. And there is a sort of veracity between them, which I think it gives the characters integrity, and like you care about them as a result of that. I do think that Jason Bateman, who is the worst human you could ever have in front of a camera, is
what?
Just
oh wow,
he's awful. He's awful in everything. He's awful here.
Wow,
and his character is awful, and it's very thinly sketched. And there are many men like that character. I'm not doubting that. I just think that. The way
not
that
all
he's
men.
Drawn
we
here.
Hear you.
Not all men is no. I'm not. I'm not even saying not all men. I'm saying all men. But he's
but
just
not Jason Bateman.
No. All men, including and especially Jason Bateman. He's just the way that it's played here feels unrealistically thin.
That's interesting.
But I still like the movie. I think that it works. It has its own spirit. I don't think it's anything especially special beyond the fact that it's very difficult to create characters that have this sort of vitality to them. But I think what Katie's saying about empathy and about even if it's very manipulated how the movie tries to get you to shit on Jennifer Garner and then come around to her side is it's very calculated. But the idea of how all these characters sort of explode out of their own headspaces, it's interesting.
I think you're not giving the movie enough credit for the way it treats Jason Bateman because that character is who all of Hollywood is. It's these kind of over-the-hill guys who are trying to retain their coolness and hang out with girls a lot younger than them. And the movies are so often blind to the dipshittery of guys
sure,
like that. And the fact that it really takes him down is so... Yeah.
And he looks like a miserable fuck from the beginning. Like, every word out of his mouth about horror movies and rock albums is just sad. It's
yeah,
so
it's a little depressing. I'm not doubting that this happens in real life, although that's never a good explanation for why something happens in a movie.
No.
But I think that it's a little transparent. I also think that if you didn't have such a terrible actor in the role, it might be a little bit, like if you had like a, I don't know why this is the first actor that popped to mind, but it's 2017 now and it did. If you had like an Adam Driver in that part, I'm sure it could have been a lot more nuanced and I would have been more forgiving of the dynamic. But
see, I think Jason Bateman's casting actually makes him, you like him because you're bringing Arrested Development to the movie.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I can't believe I didn't know you hated Jason Bateman.
That's one of the reasons why I have like no special place in my heart for Arrested Development because he sucks in it.
No, Patches is exactly right though that most of the people seeing Juno do like him from Arrested Development and you do totally bring that in with you like him.
Yeah, in the beginning scenes, he's sitting there on the couch making those kind of like Arrested Development faces about wacky things that either Jennifer Garner, who seems kind of high-strung in the beginning, or even everything coming out of Ellen Page's mouth, he's just like, what are you talking about? And he's making those Arrested Development faces, and it's totally working on most of the audience, everyone but David. And then by the end, you're just like, what a creep. And it's everyone. That's such a familiar trope. I mean, outside of Hollywood, even, Katie, you tied it to
everywhere.
Sleazy
yeah.
execs, but I mean...
No, everywhere.
Our white man problem is Jason Bateman in this movie, in Washington,
yeah, and the
everywhere.
Fact that Jason Reitman is a, you know, I think he's in his late 30s at this point, is a white guy born of nepotism who's kind of given everything in life, that he uses it to make this movie that takes down, you know, someone of his kind, and also, you know, elevate the voice of a woman who was an outsider to Hollywood. Like, Jason Reitman has made a lot of terrible choices in his career, but this was a really good one and a really good way that nepotism can pull other people up by their bootstraps,
Jason
which
Bateman,
really happens.
Jason Reitman
Simon was not given everything. He had to meet Diablo Cody.
Yes.
He had to go find her.
How did that happen? Probably in an agent's office.
There was a producer who asked her to write a script. Her book got optioned. I was reading this on the Wikipedia page. Film producer Mason Novick landed a book deal for her memoir. Then she wrote Juno, and then he gave the screenplay to Jason Reitman.
So we should all have a baby.
Yeah. What? So I both think this represents the America I want to live in, and I want to show it to the incoming president in that what white men can do with their privilege and how women can be, interesting, even if he doesn't want to fuck them.
But also that women can make mistakes, too. I think that's important, that Juno fucks up. She goes over a line. One of my favorite scenes in this movie is when Allison Janney, as her stepmom, is kind of railing on her for going over to Bateman's house. Not to like victim shame or something, but to be like, you're living in a real world with real adults, and it's about the world's about to change, and men are out to get you. You gotta like wake up, and I'm here for you. You know, here's a strong woman that you never took seriously, and I'm telling you an important lesson. Please, like, women stand together. And I thought that was an awesome moment.
Or not even like, you know, for all womankind, but just like be a decent person to the people you're around. Like, don't be an asshole. Which is, you know, the really micro version of that larger lesson you're talking about.
But
Dave, what do you think about Juno?
Garner does the same thing,
I think when I first saw it in theaters, I was too deep into thinking about all movies as potential screenplays that I marveled at, like, how well-structured it was, but much like Little Miss Sunshine, like, I left me being like, that was a movie! It had a beginning, and a middle, and an end, and everything it brought up, it talked about later, at least once more. But rewatching it for this, I was pleasantly surprised to see that it was also a good movie. But yeah, if there's a few movies, that are just, structured in a way that is so solid from like a screenwriting standpoint that if I saw that at some point while I was trying to learn screenwriting, I would sort of like write it off as easy until like it took me like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years of schooling and trying to write to realize that wasn't easy. And so like going back and being able to appreciate it as a movie about women making choices was very pleasant.
So you, like Juno, also learned something.
I did. I didn't have to have a baby.
Juno's good. You know what's better than Juno, which is a good movie, is Young Adult.
I love Young
Adult.
Young Adult is not America I want to live in.
Exactly.
Young Adult is the America you do live in. All right.
I know. Well, this is the problem. I'm worried that with Patrick's choice, it's going to be more about the horrible America we do live in. But
I have no idea what to make of Patrick's choice, listeners. So I don't think any of us do.
Maybe we should talk about it.
Maybe we should talk about it.
After this break. Every step you take,
what?
Every move you make.
This is going to be the music break for Cachet.
That seems wildly inappropriate.
No, it's
really? No, I think it's very appropriate.
No, are you kidding? It's extremely.
What is this movie? Okay, now that everyone has given me shit before doing my segment, I'm really excited to share why I picked Michael Haneke's Cachet. Or Hidden, I suppose. Did it come out as Hidden here in the U.S.? No.
I think it was just Cachet.
It
was 100%.
It was festivaled as Hidden, right?
No, it was 100% Cachet when it came out here. I believe that was always the title of Broadwell.
I see, like, film journal articles sometimes that refer to it as Hidden, so I'm never... not quite sure. Anyway, Michael Haneke's Cachet. Why did I pick this movie? I was really leaning towards picking Patterson. Because I wanted the new movie by Jim Jarmusch that we talked about on our top 10 episodes, because I thought that I should, in my melancholic state, just feeling depressed about the world, I thought maybe I needed a movie that was about personal strength and personal observation and not necessarily isolationism and cutting yourself off from the world, but to find the little moments to live life in an important way in these troubled times and build yourself up first so you can survive it all. Patterson, that's what that movie would be for me. But I decided, I don't know if it's the time to be like totally pleasant. And I wanted to pick Cachet because Cachet is a movie about forcing confrontation. It's about the amnesic present and discarding your past and being privileged enough to blame others and to ignore everything horrible that you've done in your life. And what you should really be doing is confronting that to figure out how you can make the world better or connect with people that you've wronged and really expand your horizons, but by
Wait,
force.
But what if like me, you've never wronged anyone?
Yeah, it's true.
Yes.
I'm an American. I'm perfect.
Yeah. I'm also
Then you're going to have a baby soon and you're going to figure it all out. Get ready. yeah, so I think for people who don't know, Cachet by Michael Haneke is about a family in Paris who starts receiving videotapes of their house. Someone has set up a camera and is recording the facade of their house and is delivering these cassettes and with, you know, for hours on end, just footage of their home. They don't know what to make of this. Georges, the main character, is definitely like liberal elite. He hosts kind of like a French literary PBS.
Show.
Yeah,
he's
talk
a,
show.
He's an intellectual.
It's like, how can that show doesn't exist anymore for sure. It's been defunded. Does it exist on an American television? I would love to sit around and watch people talk about books on a TV.
It's like sort
Does
of being
exist?
Defunded even in Cachet. Like he has a meeting with his agent or something where it's like, yeah, That's they got to get the money together.
I mean,
yeah,
they hope
they can get his new show.
The New York One equivalent.
Yeah, I kept thinking of like Charlie Rose. If Charlie Rose talked about only books, what a life. And he has a very nice apartment and he lives with Juliette Binoche. So he's the luckiest man in the whole world. His wife, Anne.
True.
And then they have a son. And yeah, all of a sudden they start getting these tapes. And this kind of sends Georges down the rabbit hole of figuring out who is doing this because it's terrifying. Like someone is watching you. And this is, you know, videotapes has been part of Michael Haneke's career for a long time. Benny's Tape, is it? Off the top of my head.
Benny's Video,
you know, about filming pig deaths and psychotic, the disturbing images that we get from video and how that disrupts truth and how people are internalizing that. And then now our lives are being sent to us on videotapes in Cachet. It's so disturbing to just even the banal image of their front door. It's who could be doing this? And of course, I have to get into spoilers a little bit here, so if you haven't seen the movie, turn around and go watch it.
How do you spoil this movie?
No,
I was going to say, your whole segment could just be about, like, what interpretation of America based on what you think happened in Cachet.
I had not seen the movie, and I had heard of it, obviously, but didn't really know what the plot was, and I would say there's a lot of value in not knowing what's coming, so just...
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely big surprises.
We all know that you don't believe in spoilers. Okay.
No, but the major question being, like, who is sending the videos, good luck answering that.
Sure.
Okay, so that's not a spoiler. But what Georges discovers along the way is that this moment from his past, this guy named Majid, who he grew up with, Majid was an Algerian who was orphaned and lived with Georges on the family farm. His parents were killed in a like this insane incident. I believe it's referred to as the Paris Massacre. It was happening during the Algerian War. The Parisian police attacked Algerian demonstrators, and killed. I mean, I think like hundreds of people.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that the establishment in France would rather pretend never happened.
Right. And it's a sort of thing that, like, we're in rewatching the film, I'm just like, we're in such a scary moment where people are protesting and, God forbid, like, police turn on people. Everything's been so friendly now. But, like, who knows what could happen? The violence is everywhere. And this is such a horrifying moment in French history. And it's rooted in Georges' past because Majid's family was killed. And suddenly Majid was going to be living on the farm with him. And, you know, kids will be kids, but... it turns out, as Georges is digging into his own past, being forced by these tapes, which seem to be leading him to Majid, He is forced to kind of remember these things. He visualizes Majeed spitting up blood and this moment where Majeed's cutting off a rooster's head and it's flapping everywhere. These violent memories. And it turns out that George really fucked Majeed's life over, having him expelled from the house. Now, I did just rewatch this film. Do you guys think it's totally clear why Majeed is thrown out of the house, or did he have tuberculosis? That was spitting up blood, or was that all fiction made up by George?
I mean, George says he made it up.
Right. Okay. That's what I was. It's always been a little fuzzy for me. And then I went off and if you want to read your heroes writing like Westworld fan fiction, Roger Ebert went to fucking town with Caché.
Yes.
My God.
Yeah.
Words.
He has like a couple of times. Well,
hundreds and hundreds of words about
essay,
what.
And then he has one about who he thinks did it that is easily Googleable.
Yeah. That was baffling me more. I felt more confused about the movie than I ever have. And I've seen it many, many times. And after rewatching it, just like reading Roger Ebert. Anyway. The point is, George fucked this guy, and now he's back in his life, and George is accusing Majeed of sending all these tapes, and Majeed's like, no, this is not me, and he has a son who's asking George to stop harassing them, and George can't, because he's determined, he knows that it's these people, and he has this systematic racism, like, he grew up kind of resenting the Algerians. He gets in a kind of scuffle with one person. He like runs into their bike at one point, and there's this just screaming match on the streets where you can just see he's the nicest guy. He's a liberal elite, but he has problems. He's prejudiced, and he can't get over it. And it starts a fury in him as he's hunting down Majeed. He's hunting down who he believes is sending these tapes. And for me, it just felt like, it's exactly what needs to happen to every single person in this world right now, that we need to have this, like, just jarring moment of self-realization. And if it needs to be...
Are you inviting our listeners to
videotape my house?
Your apartment and send it to you?
If that's what it takes... Well,
I don't know if I subscribe to that.
Well, what do you make of this? Do you see now why I'm kind of latching onto Caché as a film of the moment, or like a dire to have this without the videotapes. We don't need videotapes, but we do need to realize that there is an American genetic disease, basically. You know, how do you purge prejudice, racism, hate that's built into our existence? And I'm not just talking about Trump supporters. I'm not just talking about I'm talking about everyone from the liberals to the conservatives. Everyone has something that they're harboring that they need to look inward to. We talk about getting along. We talk about getting, quote unquote, out of our bubbles, whatever. That's kind of all nonsense. It's all about figuring yourself out so everyone can listen. And of course, no one can, because no one will figure themselves out. So Michael Haneke has created this trap with the videotapes and this thriller plot to basically throw someone completely off kilter and destroy their lives to show us what it really might take to reverse something so rooted in our experience.
Yeah, that's the genius of what Michael Haneke's always done, which is to be the pea under the mattress of the bourgeois middle class, which is like, find that how easy it is to disturb their copacetic sort of numb lives I was going to say lives and lifestyles at the same time, and it came out as some sort of weird aberration of the two. I think that like the moral indignation that he incites in Daniel Auteuil's character, and the racism that it provokes, the desire to repress all these unwell things. I mean, the fact that he is self-presented as this liberal intellectual that is superior to all of these things and whatnot, as the model middle class, upper middle class existence, and how these things unravel and lead to a place of uncertainty, I think is very relevant. And I think a lot of, even before the election, after the election, I think it's been a little bit more obviously polarized between good and evil, right and wrong, and so on. But I think there's been, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of white America, has had to have gut check time, you know, and really recognize their own role in a system that they'd rather stand beyond. And that's difficult. And so I think Michael Haneke probably feels his own guilt in that as well, but finds an interesting way to tackle the story.
Yeah, Black Lives Matter was kind of the main thing I thought of when I watched this movie and kind of got where you're going with this. And I think that, like David was saying, it was a gut check moment for a lot of people. And I think After the election, I've seen a lot of variations on people saying, you know, white people, you were so devastated by the results of this election. You're so surprised your country could do this. People of color have known this forever. And I think that's a lot of what's in cachet, is that as a white person, you can kind of like set something aside and be like, well, this is the country that I live in. And then you're confronted with the reality that another class of people has to live with every single day. And France, it's Algerians, and here it's, you know, black people and a lot of other Muslims, maybe now more than ever. And it's also interesting to me that this movie has a lot of background scenes of the Iraq War. I think it was came out in 2004.
It was a little later than that.
I played at Cannes in 2005, so it probably came out at the end of that year.
Okay, so the Iraq War is still ongoing. So that's kind of the, like, you know, damning modern-day consequences it's putting in the background of it. And it's just, like, the idea that, like, the Iraq War is the horrible crime that America has to atone for. It's like, oh, yeah, there was that. Now we're just really on the verge of doing so much worse. Anyway.
Dave, you were going to say something?
Oh, I just, I like that we are thinking about, you know, like, the Patches hashtag get woke segment. But I think, like, it's also important to talk about that, like, it's every time I think that you're confronted with something that you initially want to fear and jump to a conclusion, that's when you need to check whatever privilege you do have. And I think if you think that doesn't apply to you, that's where you start applying it to you. Because worst thing that's going to happen is that you figure out you have a legitimate fear, but you're going to be able to voice that, like, so much better. Like, I feel like if any of these characters had been able to voice what they were actually afraid of, A, we'd know who set the videos, and B, a lot of pain would, like, not have to transpire.
Yeah, you know, I saw this movie in college. It was my first Haneke film, and I instantly ran off to watch them all because I felt so disturbed by it. And I don't know what it says about my personality that I wanted that feeling again. I wanted to be knocked off the podium. I wanted to flail. And I'm happy that I have that feeling, because I even when we talk about movies on this podcast, sometimes we get reactions that are just like, can we just talk about the entertainment value of something? And no, like, we must be challenged. We must have jarring reactions to things. We must watch Michael Haneke films to feel fucked up and to feel like things are crazy at times. And that's what happens to someone in this movie. They're forced to see a Michael Haneke film, basically, of their own lives. There's a scene where George watches the confrontation he had with Majid in a room just hours earlier. How could that video exist? Well, we never know, but it's such a gift to him to be able to see it, and he doesn't realize it. And actually, by the end of this movie, he still doesn't realize it. The last thing we see George do is go to sleep. He curls up in bed and turns off the lights. And that's such a fuck the world, miserable moment for him. Earlier in the movie, he's speaking to his dying mother, and she's like, how are things going? He's like, we're chugging along. No great highs or lows. It's like, that's your life. That's what you... I mean, everything is fine. You don't know where your kid is. Your wife is pissed off because you're a guy who refuses to tell the truth about anything. You're just going to internalize everything because you're so confident. And everything is fine. You're just going to tell people that in real life. But people can be true, and people can look inward and watch. They should be watching videos of themselves, metaphorically speaking, not curling up in bed and going to sleep.
I find it amazing that no less than Roger Ebert is concerned with trying to figure out who sent the tapes, because I feel like there's no answer. He makes no effort to tell you who sent the tapes. It doesn't matter.
I mean, the last scene, I guess, could tip off.
That never occurred to me. I assumed that it was just the son kind of going after the one son going after the other to kind of continue the confrontation.
It's the son being better. You don't even necessarily know if they're in cahoots, or if Majid's son knows him, or maybe they know each other from school and don't even realize who their parents are. I'm not sure why it would ever come up.
Majid's son is much older than the other
one. In fairness to Roger Ebert, the piece is not, it's not like a fucking Cinema Sins.
Are you kidding
me? Trailer.
Go on RogerEbert.com and read some of his cachet stuff.
It is open on my computer screen where it has been for 2 days.
It's all, it's like, stop 30 minutes into the DVD and analyze this frame.
This is how, but that's how film analysis works. I mean, it's a means to an end. And the end is not to say, like people picking apart the Stranger Things 2 trailer to look for clues about what the fucking monster is.
You're an asshole.
Drive from whatever. Fuck that show forever. He's doing it to make a point about what Haneke is and is not looking for. I'm not always the first person to rush to Roger Ebert's defense, but I think that
I'll disagree with you on his piece.
What you're accusing it of.
But there's plenty of great writing about the film that is not entranced by the mystery here, and certainly Haneke is not too, because he, you know, in many interviews has said there is no answer. It could be God himself making the tapes. Although he did say that he gave them dialogue to speak in that final scene. Oh, who cares? I mean, there's just so much to this movie that is more important. The idea of getting those tapes at all. It's something we could all stand to receive. I don't know how. What is it?
What would if Donald Trump were to watch this movie, like what? What do you
or if all of us
out of it?
Donald Trump would not make it through the first shot of this movie. He would be walking around the White House in his fucking bathroom robe, checking Twitter. There was not a chance in hell. Although I still like Matt's choice. I just don't think that Donald Trump would.
I'm not trying to show Donald Trump this movie.
He would realize that he's been misdiagnosing TB for all of his life. I think is what he'd learn.
I think people in the country could stand to say things out loud to themselves. You know what they believe. You know the Twitter eggs of the world could stand to look inward somehow. I don't know how it happens though. Like, how does it happen?
If you don't have the desire to look inward, you're not going to see this movie and do that looking inward.
Yeah. So how do you change this, like, genetic disease of prejudice? I guess that's like the age old question.
you steal all their stuff.
This is probably sounds so wrong, but like. That's a great setup. This is a great setup.
Go through.
We could just end the segment and not go there.
No, I'm just so tired of people who hate. It just seems so exhausting. Like, get over it, man. What is your problem? I don't understand it's so dumb. What is wrong with people?
I mean, it does sound silly, but also I think it's a totally valid response to what is happening in the world right now. Like, who has the energy to hate people that much?
That's what I mean. It sounds crazy.
Is racism that good? Is power like that? Is it that good?
What do you want, David Duke? Like, what do you want? It's so exhausting.
It's just so much easier to not give a shit about. I mean, I'm sure it's easy to not give a shit about other people, but it's even easier to like just not need to go out of your way to destroy innocent lives.
Well,
like,
I think I've been so in awe of all the like protesting and displays of affection and positivity that this is, I guess, our videotape in some ways, trying to reflect the world back to people. I don't know if it works. I don't know if it can work, but that standing together as people against hate, that's a good thing. So I'll try and end it on a positive note.
You may need to play Videotape by Radiohead. After how many times Pat just said videotape?
Cassette tape. Come on, boy, 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 boy. Y'all can't deny it, I'm a fucking rider. Come on, boy, 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 boy. Y'all can't deny it, y'all can't deny it. Come on, boy, 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 boy. Y'all can't deny it, I'm a fucking rider.
All right, so for my pick, the movie that I thought put forward the America that I would like to see us return to, the thing that can make this already great country even greater. Unfortunately, it doesn't have maybe as much of a personal connection to me as Juno does to Katie, or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington does to Dave, or I don't know, didn't sound like cachet, especially personal connection to Matt, but still, it is still a movie that I've watched many times, more times than I can count, often in bite-sized pieces because it doesn't necessarily demand to be watched in its entirety. And I find resonates with me a little bit more all the time while remaining the same infectious, delivery system of joy that, it always has been for me. And that is Jacob Krupnik's Girl Walk All Day, which is a movie that was originally released on Vimeo one chapter at a time in 2010, I want to say, in 2011, in the fall of 2011, and then played at South By shortly thereafter. And is, if you haven't seen it or any part of it, it is essentially a feature-length music video, although that is being very reductive, set to the Girl Talk album All Day. But the Girl Walk bit is because the 70-minute music video follows a character known as The Girl, who is played by future Good Wife star, is probably not right, but supporting player, an incredible dancer, and generational icon, Anne Marson.
And she does a lot on YouTube now.
Does she? I was just thinking today, what's she up to these days?
It's awesome. The stuff she does is absolutely insane, but...
I have absolutely no doubt that what she does is awesome right now, even if I have yet to see it for myself. Because the reason that I responded to... I don't know really where to begin with this. I mean, it's essentially 70 minutes of her dancing through public spaces in... Manhattan, a few brief sojourns into other boroughs. There is a little bit of a story involving two male dancers, one of whom is a guy named Dae Omiya, known as the gentleman in the film, who's a suitor for affections, and this other character called the Creep, who's played by John Doyle, who's another dancer, who's a little bit more nefarious, but and then there are other dancers that are thrown in there. There are dancers who are planted in these public spaces where the girl dances through and sort of joined to the action. But really, the biggest character is New York City itself. And all of the members of the public who are around, be they people who are sitting at one of the restaurants in Chelsea near that Apple store watching the people dance, or they're in the subway, or they're at the Occupy Wall Street rally where they attend, or they're just gawking at them from wherever, the Hasidic Jew who says that you should always be happy when she dances by, or so on. They all play a role in this portrait of the power of public spectacle and the confluence of various people and identities that make up New York City. And this is a New York-specific movie. I don't think this movie could really exist anywhere else because it draws on not only all these site-specific places, but on all of... I mean, this is still America as a melting pot. This is... Katie mentioned earlier that all of our movies were predominantly white, and while the main character in this film is white, this is a movie that celebrates the diversity of New York City at every available opportunity, oftentimes in... sort of admittedly segregated bits and pieces. She goes up to Harlem here. She goes into the jewelry district there. She goes into Chinatown next. But the way that it brings them all together, that it celebrates the togetherness of everybody in the city, the way that it builds these set pieces that really go out of their way to make sure that they highlight New York's diversity, whether she's dancing with, a group of, Middle Eastern women in front of a museum or getting involved in the Occupy Wall Street or movement or dancing with a number of mostly black teenage girls on the Williamsburg Bridge and so on. There is this incredible sense of joy that is galvanizing all the people in New York together and by extension sort of everyone in the country. I mean, yes, it's because of the way that New York City is built. I think this film could really only be made here. She would have danced herself to death if it took place in Los Angeles. But she is, because it's a big city, but she, brings everyone together in it's a really a celebration amongst all the other things that I've already mentioned of what America can, should, was designed to be. And, I think watching it in our current climate, I just find it really sort of overwhelmingly beautiful just because of the happiness involved. I mean, it's like every viral video that you've seen that has had a gooey core, every video of two strangers forming an unlikely friendship or whatever the case might be, they all give you the same feeling. It's all the same chemicals in your brain that are firing. And this movie is like a fatal dose of all of that stuff. And I've connected to it personally or somewhat personally because I could not be more unlike the character of the girl because I am a neurotic Jewish boy. And I'm always like, you know, at least some part of me is ashamed of myself in public. just by virtue of my existence. And, you know, I refuse to speak on elevators. It's true. When I'm not just with one other person. And I am always, you know, don't want to talk too loud. Don't want to make too much of a scene. But I desperately want to do all of those things. It's just not in my nature. But there's the confidence with which this character, the girl, turns every aspect of New York into her own playground, and in a very inviting way. It's not at all like a teenage sort of unctuousness or aggressiveness where she's like, get out of my space, like you should be, feel foolish to be here. I mean, the way that she dances in the Apple Store or Yankee Stadium or in Bloomingdale's, it's also inviting to everyone who comes by, it just to sort of partake in this sense of happiness that we can all share this space together and all these incredible things that we've built. And we can all bear witness to one another doing these things and having their own joy. And, I think it's the kind of thing that I watch and wish that I could better own in my own sense. It's easier for me to say, to appreciate the beauty of the multiculturalism that's on display here than it is to, take for myself the confidence that, Anne Marson's character has in the story and whatnot. The music's also really great. The music, of course, you know, it's so multicultural to begin with. It's this mashup, of all these different musical styles. You're crashing Jay-Z into Radiohead, into Portishead, into 90s rap, into 80s rap, and so on, into a lot of contemporary R&B. And it really just feels like this beautiful collision of everything that makes America great. And I think, Donald Trump would probably bleed out of his eye holes if he watched this, and tell everyone to turn the sound off. But this is the kind of the America that, I think is, we are intractably heading towards. It's not something that can be stopped other than, camps, which I'm really hoping we avoid. But I think, I find it really beautiful. I always have in an emotional way, and now I think in more of a socio-political way as well.
Yeah, I think this really makes the best argument for New York is maybe the best model of what America can be. And I know that in my segment I argued against trying to do anything too city-focused, but I like the version of New York that this movie presents, that it's not the version of New York that's in most movies. It's not as white. It's not as rich. It's not as homogenized. The way you talk about the melting pot, like, you know, New York has served that symbolic function for centuries. And I think Girl Walk makes a really good argument that it still exists, even though it can really feel like it's been shoved out at this point.
But is there something?
This is a weird one to...
No, go, Dave. Go.
No, this is a weird one for me to revisit just because... A, not in New York anymore. B, when I was in New York, Girl Talk was my jam. Not just this album, but the preceding albums. So to see, and then, you know, like Dave was talking about, or David and Katie talked about, this is the side of New York that was accessible to us purely through public space and travel, because very rarely, or maybe never, are they in a space that is exclusive 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. But, like, it was really, for me, I feel like this is America that definitely I've seen exist. Like, there was definitely times early on in New York where, you know, it was all sunshine and Central Park, and why not dance around? So that definitely gave me more hope, more so than other movies on this podcast, maybe even my own, that it's possible for this world to exist.
Yeah, I mean, I think the shared space element of it, I mean, all of these people living together, I think is really strong. What was I going to say? I can't, my own Girl Talk experience was going to a show in like 2009 with a girl who, and when you go to a Girl Talk show back when, I don't know, Greg Gills is still doing shows, but, they were unique in that as soon as the show starts, because it's just a guy at a DJ booth, essentially, everybody jumps on stage and you could just dance like on top of him as he's playing. And that's exactly what I did with this girl who I went with. And then she jumps off the stage, which was, I think it was at Tao for anyone, all my New Yorkers, to keep this New York centric, on 9th Avenue, 14th Street, and, jumped in the first song directly on a broken glass. and her foot exploded.
Oh.
And we spent the rest of the night in the hospital at the end. But I got one really good song. And then I had this movie, so it's okay. And her foot's fine, so, you know. All things
I kind of wanted to just respond to what you were saying about New York and the amazing diversity that we have here. You could feel it. Even when you're not dancing around the city, if you're just walking around the city, you feel something. You feel community at all times, especially in the last few weeks. But I'm always conflicted because, you know, I definitely agree with everyone who fires back at the bubble talk with saying that New York is, everyone else is kind of in a bubble at times. Like, we are, it's ideal to have this kind of diversity, this community here. But on this podcast, certainly, we can get very New York-centric. And David, I know that you have yelled at people, our listeners, telling them, get your ass to New York if you care about film, if you care about certain walks of life, if, like, New York is the only place. And I've seen you exit the tri-state area and start shuddering. Like, you get scared going out in the world. The real America is not where you want to be.
Listen.
But is there something to that? Like, what is this balance? What is this, like, being too New York? Can you be too New York centric? Can you get caught up in what New York has to offer? And is there something to forget about the rest of America? Or are we outside the bubble? Are we in the, like, ideal place?
Bubble is a dirty word.
Bubble is a word in the air right now. So.
It's a dirty word. But I think that, you know, I come here to praise New York, not to bury it. I think that there are conversations that can be had about the idea of just pretending the rest of the country doesn't exist and the negatives involved in doing so. But this movie doesn't ask you to do that. It just celebrates what's here. And that is part of what I love about it, because I think that, you know, exactly what Katie said, which is just that this is the example of what New York can be as a melting pot. It's a microcosm of what makes America special and what makes America great, and what makes a New York a target, you know. And I think that and what makes it vilified by other people in our country, because it's so unapologetically defies the attitudes that plague some other parts of this country. And you can find those attitudes in New York. I mean, we're not immune to them here, but
guys who invaded Shia LaBeouf's art project at the Museum of Moving Image and were screaming about supporting Trump.
Absolutely. absolutely.
Diversity, awesome.
Yeah, so, I mean, but I do think that I'll extrapolate what I was saying about my own lack of confidence and the confidence that I love seeing in Anne Marsden's character here and the coolness that she exhibits. But if everyone could feel a smidgen of that ability to be comfortable in their own skin, and I come at it from one place of privilege, but I think that if you extrapolate that to people who are unsafe on the streets because the way the police look at them, or are unsafe just by nature of their sexual identity or who they are, or any part of what makes them who they are, and they just want to live a little bit louder and be themselves, if we were all able to do that safely with the freedom that the girl character does here in this film, and be because of she has the cameras around her, it's transformed. I mean, all the reactions, if you're big and burly enough in New York with your attitude, your actions, everyone will sort of back off. You know, if you're ranting or muttering to yourself on the subway, like, people will give you a 5-foot perimeter. Liz Lemon learns this lesson very well in one episode of 30 Rock. If you look like you smell, you get a little space on the subway. But if we could all have that feeling of sort of collective warmth and appreciation to act in that way, maybe we would all feel more comfortable acting that way in ourselves. And I think that's a beautiful idea. And as much as I say that this movie could really only exist in New York, I would love to see a sequel that skews the idea maybe in a slightly different direction, focuses on some other ideas, but that, just because I want to see more of it, and it better fucking star Anne Marsden.
I think it's going to be a tough 4 years for New York, because Donald Trump is from New York, and the version of New York that he represents is basically the opposite of what's in Girl Walk in every possible way. I think if this movie came out this year, it would be seen as like an act of rebuke of Trump. And I kind of like watching it in that way. I like seeing the version of New York that I saw marching in the Women's March a couple weeks ago, or that, like we were saying, or there's this viral story going out where there was a, you know, someone had drawn swastikas in Sharpie on the subway, and then, you know, everyone on the train dug out their Purell and wiped it off. Like those are things that happen. Like everyone has a New York story like that. Like that is actually the city that this is.
I'd rather say that it's going to be, rather than being a tough 4 years for New York because of Trump, I'd like to think it'll be a tough 4 years for Trump because of New York.
Yes. He will be booed in his home city.
Although
for the rest
I want to watch Man Lurch Half Day and his
video. Yeah, it's very good.
What's
very
his
good.
Take?
Okay, Patches. You win this round.
Set up the video camera. Mysterious force in the White House. You could film it, cachet style.
What if you
just safety dance? That's the soundtrack.
What if you set it up and it was him dancing around the Oval Office like Ann Marson? That does it for the sixth quarter quell of the Fighting in the War Room era. I can't count.
We outlasted the Hunger Games franchise.
We sure did outlast the Hunger Games franchise. And the Divergent franchise, for that matter, which was the Hunger Games knockoff that didn't even pan out. Anyway, we love doing these. We hope you enjoyed this one. We'll be back next week with a regular episode. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm a senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them, you can leave comments, and maybe you can leave your contact information when I get in touch with you for winning prizes. Now, that's probably not safe enough. We'll figure that out. Dave will figure that out. He knows best. Dave.
Jeez.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, I guess I'll figure that out. I'm Dave Gonzalez, but my first name, DA7E. That is my Twitter handle. This week, I was one of the people that did not go, quote, much deeper than the people who pick apart the Stranger Things trailer, fuck that show forever. my Stranger Things Season 2 trailer breakdown is at Thrillist.com.
It was really interesting. It has a lot of literary references. I thought it was pretty damn good.
I would love to have a supercut of all the things to which I've said fuck that thing forever about over the years on the show.
I'm sure someone has the time. Not me, though. David.
Yes, I'm still laughing about Man Lurch Half Day. I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of my writing these days on IndieWire. And you can find all of us together on Facebook, which has been very active for us recently after Matt asked people to suggest topics for this quarter quell on Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Peter Rich. I'm on VanityFair.com. I'm on the Little Gold Men podcast talking about Oscars if you want to hear more of that. And, you know, on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, where I also talk about the Oscars, probably. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we love hearing from you and your more suggestions for quarter quells. We'll keep writing them down. There will be another one in just 47?
Or like movies they that think represent America.
Yes, please. That would be
great.
People
who are not me.
Yeah, and I'm the topic that we started with, what you would show the incoming president, I would love suggestions on that as well. We expanded the idea, but I still think it's a really great discussion point. And I think, what was the name of the person who suggested it again?
Cyrus.
Thank you, Cyrus. And thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.